WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
A recent Time magazine cover story called The Truth About the Female Body was about the latest controversies over whether the behavioral differences between men and women have been determined by biology and evolution. Barbara Ehrenreich, the author of the article, described a new book titled Woman as a provocative treatise on women's bodies. My guest is the author of that book, Natalie Anger, who writes about biology for the New York Times. She describes her book as an attempt to find a way to think about the biology of being female without falling into the sludge of biological determinism. She says she's tired of reading the latest books on evolutionary psychology or neo-Darwinism or gender biology that try to use science to prove that women are really like all the old canards, that women have a weaker sex drive than men, a relatively greater thirst for monogamy, a comparative lack of interest in achievement and renown, and a quiet, self-contained nature. She thinks these recent studies are reviving a lot of old gender stereotypes.
I think, for example, the idea that the only thing that men care about in a woman is her appearance, and that the thing that a woman looks for in a man is signs of high status, industriousness, the ability to take care of her and her offspring. Some of these ideas don't even make particular sense to me. The idea that men only care about a woman's appearance and not about her skillfulness as a mother, her intelligence, all the other things that a Stone Age man might have seen as useful in somebody who was going to be raising children. So it's just gotten to the point where even though the evolutionary psychologist may say, we're not so, I mean, don't put up this straw man and don't make it sound so simplistic. In fact, the way it gets spoon-fed to the public, it often is really simplistic.
What is some of the research evolutionary psychologists are using to back up claims about men caring more about women's appearance and women caring more about men's status?
Well, the most famous bit of data that's relied on for a lot of these claims in mate choice are these very famous mate choice surveys by David Boss and collaborators of his, supposedly done across a wide diversity of cultures, 37 different countries, all six populated continents, and they all show the same thing. Men place higher emphasis on a woman's appearance, and woman places higher emphasis on a man's earning power and ambitiousness. And so supposedly these are these cross-cultural surveys that are unerring in the conclusions that they reach. However, there are several things to be pointed out about these. There have been a lot of criticisms of these surveys, one of them being that even though they're claiming to be cross-cultural, they're really, in all 37 countries, dealing with a very similar population of people, that is, people in universities and colleges. Most of these surveys are given out to college students. So even if it's a college student in India versus a college student at UCLA, it's still a college student. So a lot of incredibly sweeping claims are made. The other thing that I think is a problem is that when you look at the results from a lot of these mate choice surveys, you see amazing similarities between what men and women think are important. They think, for example, kindness, intelligence, and a good sense of humor, and they place those all above these other qualities that we're emphasizing in evolutionary psychology, that is, that men rate looks higher, women financial power higher. You really have to go down to like four or five tiers before you see that difference. And so it's, why are we emphasizing this fourth or fifth tier over the similarities? So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to call it into question.
What evidence are evolutionary psychologists and other biologists using from research in the animal world to describe gender differences in humans?
Well, for example, a lot of times we look to close relatives like the chimpanzees, the common chimpanzees, where you do see a lot of similarities in behaviors between humans and chimpanzees, and you know that the males do try to control the females, and the females do seem to be somewhat more sedate in their behaviors, except during times when they're in estrus, in which case they actually go wild. And so a lot of the theorizing that's done about primitive human nature is based on analogies with common chimpanzees. Another thing that some of the critics of this simple-minded evolutionary psychology raise is, well, we could as easily look at the bonobos, the pygmy chimpanzees, for if we want to draw comparisons, because the bonobos are as closely related to us genetically as the common chimpanzees are. And in the case of the bonobos, you see very different kinds of behaviors. In that case, you see sexuality being much more overt, particularly among females, and the females banding together to protect each other. And it's a whole different kind of society that they have. So you could as easily say, well, why use the common chimpanzees as some kind of template rather than the bonobos? Probably there's a little of both of them in us. So that's one of the problems. The other thing is there's been some very interesting research coming out, even from chimpanzee data, where it was always assumed that the female chimpanzees, although they were known to mate promiscuously, would mate with the males within their troop, because after all, those males tend to be the ones they spend the most time with. The males are very aggressive in trying to control female movements. And so it was assumed that those males, particularly the alpha males in those groups, would be the ones fathering the most offspring in the group. Well, very recent DNA studies have shown that, in fact, there's very little of that going on, and most of the females are going out of the troop to mate with males elsewhere, and they're taking considerable risks to do that. They're taking risks to themselves because if the males caught them, they'd really try to beat them up seriously. They take risks to their offspring because there's evidence that if the males think that the offspring are not their own, they will kill them. And yet the females are going outside of the troop for secret matings with other males, taking the initiative and doing that. We don't yet know why, but what we can say is that the old idea that males are ardent and seek out sex and females sit around and wait for sex to come to them is obviously not true, even in our closest relatives, the chimpanzees.
So you think that some evolutionary biologists are very selective in the research that they use from the animal world?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that, you know, I mean, there's so much data out there and we don't, you know, every species seems to have its own particular assortment of behaviors, so it's hard to make an exact kind of comparison. But the accruing evidence seems to be that there's benefits for promiscuity for both males and females, and that they're going to be opportunistic about it. That, you know, to say, well, males have more of an incentive to have multiple matings because they can impregnate infinite numbers of females. Well, females may have other reasons for promiscuity, and so why emphasize the male's promiscuity over the female's? It just doesn't make sense. The question is, under what circumstances are you likely to see any of this behavior arising, not is it male-specific or female-specific?
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Natalie Anger. She covers biology for The New York Times. Her new book is called Woman, An Intimate Geography. I think women would like to think that biology isn't destiny. In other words, that the fact that you're a woman and you have a woman's body and a woman's hormones doesn't mean that you're necessarily passive and weak, which is what the assumption, I think, often was. you know, that if you were a woman, this is what your makeup was. On the other hand, you've come to the conclusion that we have to recognize that hormones really do shape a lot of behavior, and you want to understand more about hormones and how they work. So let's talk about hormones a little bit. First of all, just give us a sense of how your thinking has changed about hormones.
Well, I think I used to be less interested in hormones, thinking that they were relatively unimportant. And my own experience with a disease that I had when I was in my 20s, and I had thyroid disease, and all of a sudden I was very conscious of how overwhelming the effects of hormones can be on the body. So that got me thinking about them. And then I started studying estrogen and testosterone, the classic female versus male hormones, and I began to realize that there was something interesting going on, although probably not in any kind of simple model that we may have formulated before.
We tend to think of estrogen as the woman's hormone and testosterone as the male hormone, but it turns out men and women have some of each, I imagine in different proportions.
Yes, and very different proportions, particularly testosterone. Men have perhaps 10 times the concentration of testosterone in their blood as women do, whereas women have the cycling levels of estrogen. So they peak in mid-cycle during ovulation and fall. And when they're peaking, they're about 10 times greater than what you see in a man. So it's this tenfold difference seems to be the case in either direction.
Do the hormones perform differently in male and female bodies?
Well, that's a good question, because it's quite possible that, in fact, they end up doing very similar things, but they are using sort of different routes to get there. I mean, one of the interesting things to realize about estrogen and testosterone is they're very closely related, and that testosterone is often converted into estrogen in men's bodies and exerts many of its effects as estrogen. So it's hard to say, well, testosterone does this, estrogen does that, because there's these enzymatic conversions that go on. But it is also possible that, you know, you can take many different routes to the same effect. And so it's hard to say, well, men need 10 times more of this testosterone to get the effects. Why is that? We don't know, but they have it, so they probably do need it.
Now, there's a couple of hormones that I think are really unfamiliar to most of us who don't follow science closely, that you say appear to be essential to family and other social relationships among mammals. I'm thinking of vasopressin and oxytocin. Let's start with oxytocin. What is it?
This is a small peptide hormone. It's a little piece of protein that acts in the brain specifically, and it also is released in the body during times of maternal behaviors. It's part of what allows you to give birth. It causes the uterus to contract, and it also causes the breast cells to contract and expel milk. So it's performing these very sort of functional and pragmatic jobs. And the question is, is it also having an effect in the brain that goes along with those functions that may increase affiliative, maternal, loving behaviors? And some of the early evidence suggests that it is a kind of an emotional emulsifier. And I talk about some of the research that's been done with women who are breastfeeding and how they can actually see the pulsing of oxytocin during breastfeeding. And when they talk to the women later about their feelings and their personalities and how it's changed during breastfeeding, it seems that a stronger oxytocin surge is associated with a greater feeling of mellowness and of relaxation and bonding.
What about vasopressin?
And that vasopressin, which is a close, it's kind of like, you know, testosterone and estrogen are related, and vasopressin and oxytocin are related. And vasopressin is released particularly, it's released in females after intercourse, but it seems to play a particularly strong role in males after intercourse and in species where they form into little pair bonds and really sort of cuddle up and seem to fall in love. Vasopressin seems to perform the role of affiliative hormone in the males, whereas oxytocin is somewhat more important in the females.
What's some of the most exciting research on the horizon now that would help us understand male and female bodies and behavior?
I think that perhaps the more we understand about the brain, the better off we are. The more we understand about the areas of the brain that sort of are involved in different emotions or behaviors, then I think what we'll start to see is, again, it usually seems to be a case of phenomenal overlap between men and women. So, you know, the more we understand about that, perhaps the less likely we are to emphasize differences. I also believe that the more things are changing and the more we see that people can change. I mean, when you think about it, it's spectacular that since the 1960s, the number of women who have entered the professions like law and medicine has just skyrocketed. It is such a short amount of change, one generation, much too short a time for any genetic changes to have occurred. So it suggests inherent flexibility and plasticity in our sort of behavioral palette.
Natalie Andrew, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Natalie Andrew writes about science for the New York Times. Her new book is called Woman, An Intimate Geography. This is Fresh Air.